Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. The Mitchell family has owned the Rutland Herald since 1947. Last night, they announced they plan to sell the Herald and the Barrie Montpelier Times Argus, as well as affiliated print and online publications to Reed Brower and Chip Harris. Brower is the principal owner of Maine Today Media, which is Maine's largest news-gathering organization with nearly 400 employees. Among the papers they publish are the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, and Kennebec Journal, among others. Chip Harris is the co-founder of Upper Valley Press Incorporated, which prints newspapers, advertising inserts, and operates a saturation mail company in eastern Vermont and central New Hampshire. Late this morning, our producer Patty Daniels spoke with Rob Mitchell, editor-in-chief of the Rutland Herald, about his family's decision to sell the papers.
Tell me when your family first considered selling the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus.
There's been a number of points over, actually, decades that it has come up, and each time before this, we've not made that decision. I think the most, probably the most serious consideration in the past was in the 80s when the Nobles, who are our former partners, said they wanted out, and we didn't know how we would manage to buy them out. But we did, figure that out and kept on going. So, I think over the last couple of years, it just has been increasingly apparent to us and many other families like us that it is really difficult to be an independent family-owned newspaper in this day and age. And so that's probably the background on what led to where we are today.
What were some of the specific circumstances that have changed recently that led to the sale right now as opposed to maybe a few years ago?
The needs of a local media company, in particular newspapers, I mean, I can speak to that directly, is the, we need to try new things and innovate and really be entrepreneurial, which takes a lot of time and effort, and at the same time, continue to do what we've always done in putting out a solid print newspaper. And the need to innovate is quickly outpacing the other priorities. And without extra help, which we feel we've gotten in this move, it's really difficult to kind of to have your priorities in the correct order. And I guess what I'm trying to say is what's changed is that the need for resources to be devoted to our future has grown rapidly, even as the resources available from our existing print operation is continuing a trend that's been happening for years. So,
tell us about Reed Brower and Chip Harris. Why do you feel like they're the right owners for the Herald and the Times Argus?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. They are both entrepreneurs, and they're both journalists in the sense that they are, Chip has worked as a reporter and editor in his career, and Reed has maintained a commitment to journalism and the role of a community journalism operation, in his case, a lot of weekly newspapers and the Portland Press Herald. And more than that, Reed in particular, but Chip as well, are entrepreneurs. And that's a real need for newspapers in this day and age. So,
can you provide us more terms of the sale?
I can't. I'm sorry.
Will readers notice any changes to the Rutland Herald? Will it go back to printing daily papers at the Times Argus? Will the digital product look different? What should readers and your audience expect?
Right off the bat, I guess the easy answer is I don't know. But on the digital editions, we have started an overhaul. It's still behind the scenes right now, but we expect this to help us move that forward quicker. So that's coming, but it, you know, I don't have any specifics at the moment. So
some of the financial problems that your own paper reported on were coming to light in the last week. Were those a symptom that pushed for the sale to be finalized, or was that something that was occurring as the details of the sale were being worked out anyway?
I would say that they contributed. So, but I can't say more than that. So,
your family has owned the Herald for almost 70 years and the Times-Argus for almost 50. Mm-hmm. What have the last several weeks been like for you?
I don't know if I could answer that in any simple way. There's a, you know, literally my entire life, my family has owned these newspapers, and almost my father's entire life. And, you know, the things I grew up with, and the inside view of what it takes to maintain a community institution, and the dedication that it takes, not just for us as a family, but for our reporters and our employees and everything. And I think my greater fear in all this was that it would all come to an end. And I think we have managed to find a way forward, which is a great relief. And, you know, I think as a whole, and for us locally, you know, this industry has been going through change, and there's been a lot of grieving by journalists for what we've lost. And, you know, I'm hopeful that out of all this, we are building something new. And, you know, that's what I see my career from here on out is about. And so, you know, and I think that is going on in places like ours all over the country. And, you know, I just want people to know that we have always, and this is how I was raised, we have always felt that these newspapers are not truly ours. They are an asset and a resource of the state of Vermont and of the wonderful cities we serve. And that is really what drove a lot of this decision, is to make sure that they continue on for these communities and for the state.
That's Rob Mitchell, editor-in-chief of the Rutland Herald, talking with our producer Patty Daniels late this morning about his family's decision to sell the Herald and the Barry Montpelier Times Argus papers they have owned for decades. Well, we're joined now by David Motes, the editorial page editor for the Rutland Herald. Motes won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his editorials in the Herald about civil unions. And David, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Nina.
I should also point out that David is a commentator for VPR. And, you know, David, we could hear the sadness in Rob Mitchell's voice just now. I'm wondering, what was your reaction when you learned about the sale?
I learned about the sale this morning when I opened up my iPhone at home early this morning. That was the first I knew about it.
And really?
Yes. I mean, they posted it online at 10 o'clock last night. And so I hadn't heard until this morning. And so I saw it, and my reaction was relief. As Rob said, in the sense that this is a way forward, and then apprehension, because I didn't really know about this this newspaper group over in Maine, and I started to look, and I looked at the Portland Press Herald's website, and they have a really good website, and I started to think about it, and I thought, well, this looks like a good fit. Of course, there's sadness. I mean, the sadness really started to set in a few weeks ago when they announced that they were reducing the print run from 7 days a week to 4 days a week with 7 days online, there was something that was quite a demarcation line for me. There was a lot of sadness about that, like something had changed. And then the recent turmoil around the financial situation last week, there's been a lot of kind of emotional stuff going on at the paper, and you could hear it in Rob's voice. The Mitchell family is deeply committed at an emotional level, a personal level, a professional level, at a community level to these papers being part of the community. And I think I spoke with Rob this morning, and I think there's a lot of relief at the fact that he believes that this is a way forward for helping them keep the newspapers alive in the community.
David, you talked about the financial reports that came out last week in Friday's paper, and they were quite a shocker, I thought. It is tough for any business to go through financial hardship and difficulties. It's another thing entirely when it's a newspaper that's kind of expected to be open and public about that. And I'm curious, how did you feel about the paper reporting on its own financial issues? You're not, as an editorial writer, you're not in the newsroom. So what did you make of Gordon Drichula's article last Friday talking about bounce checks for some employees and expense accounts that were going unpaid?
You're right. I'm not in the newsroom. And so when that story came out Friday morning, it was news to me. And sometimes I'm the last to learn about the scuttlebutt in the newsroom. And so I was... I had heard things about bounce checks and so on, but I really wasn't fully aware. And I was kind of taken aback by the story, like, why are we airing our dirty laundry like this? But then, I realized how important it was, and I drew an analogy. What if Green Mountain Power was having financial problems, an important institution in our community and the state? We would be expected to report on it. And so I guess... we had a responsibility to report on ourselves. It's a tough thing, and our newsroom includes a bunch of committed journalists who want to do the right thing.
What's the mood like at the Herald? What's it been like at the past week? Obviously, this bombshell dropped last night, so things are probably very different now. But over the last few days, there seemed to be a calmness. You didn't hear reporters talking. There were no more news accounts in the paper, really, after a staff meeting last Monday where I think management, Rob Mitchell and his father, kind of asked everybody to hold steady, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. What's the mood been like at the Herald since that meeting?
We had the meeting on Monday. We had the general meeting for the whole paper, and then there was a newsroom meeting of reporters and editors that I was at, and that was quite emotional. The reporters were quite impassioned about the importance of us reporting on ourselves and doing the right thing. And then there was the stuff hanging over the head of the paper financially, and which was there was a lot of uncertainty. But we had been reassured there would be news at the end of the week, and that things were there was light at the end of the tunnel. And so after Monday, it has been quiet and subdued at the paper Tuesday and Wednesday. And I haven't been there today because I'm up here at VPR. But I'm going to go back. And I assume that, I don't know. I suppose maybe people have a reaction like mine, like the hope that this is a way forward.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Rutland Herald and its sister paper, the Barrie-Montpelier Times-Argus. It was announced last night that the papers would be sold. We'd love to hear what you think of this sale and the future of newspapers in general. Is local news worth paying for? Is there a better, more cost-effective, or creative way to provide it? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and this is Vermont Edition. And today, the future of the local newspaper. Questions were swirling in Rutland for the past week about the future of the Rutland Herald. Julian Fenn is a Shrewsbury resident who worried the Herald might disappear completely.
I think it's one of the only real solid news sources we have in this part of the state. You know, the Burlington Free Press tends to focus on Chittenden County, VT Digger, same situation, 7 days as usually Montpelier. And we really don't have a strong voice to get out local news here in Rutland. And if we lost the Herald, or even if it just went to online, a lot of folks in this community don't have access to computers. And, you know, they would lose out, and we would lose out on being able to talk about a lot of important issues that are facing us here in Rutland County, like, you know, refugee resettlement and opiate addiction and things like that that they are able to touch on every day. And if we lose that, I think it could have a really detrimental effect on the community.
Listeners, do you feel that way about your local paper? If local news is important, what's the right financial model for keeping the industry healthy? You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've been talking with David Motes, editorial page editor for the Rutland Herald, which announced last night that it would be purchased by a newspaper group in Maine. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now, journalism professor and media historian David Mindich, who teaches at St. Michael's College. He's also on the board of VT Digger. David Mindich, you've been watching the developments over the last week at the Herald and the Times Argus. What was your reaction to their own reporting and the news last night that the papers are being sold?
Well, when I first moved to Burlington in 1996, I was told that the two most important papers in the state were the Burlington Free Press and the Rutland Herald. And I've, over the years, found that both of them have been very important news sources for me. And so I had a moment of panic when I heard that there were financial troubles at the Rutland Herald, and particularly the decline of the print edition. And I think it's also very important for journalists to report on the truth wherever they find it, even in their own newsroom. It is, as David Motes said, a very difficult balancing act because you don't want to do too much navel-gazing and reporting on yourself. But at the same time, it is an institution. It's a Vermont institution, and a very important Vermont institution, and it's great that that reporters reported on the financial issues.
Talking about it as an institution, being family-owned, I think a lot of people took special pride in that. I know they did in Rutland. Some Rutland Herald and Times Argus readers might be worried about how the sale of the papers will impact their content. How important is it to have a local or family-owned paper versus, say, a paper being part of a chain or a much larger media company?
Well, I think if you look, I'm very excited to be sitting in the studio with a Pulitzer Prize winner. And if you look at the editorials from 2000, when David Motes won his Pulitzer for reporting principally on civil unions, the Burlington Free Press had editorials as well, but the editorials were so non-committal. They said things like, we need leadership. And I think that that's directly a reflection of kind of a corporate mindset. And I'm a big fan of the Burlington Free Press, but I think in this particular case, the editorials that the Rutland Herald put forth that were written by David Motes really showed leadership in the classic way, not this kind of vague "we need leadership." That the Rutland Herald really took a stand, a civil rights stand, which years later we're still celebrating.
I want to talk more about the challenges facing newspapers across the country, because the financial hardship and cost-cutting measures that we've seen at the Herald are by no means unique. They're occurring in newsrooms across the country. As readership changes and advertising revenues drop, cost to print and deliver papers continue to go up. According to the Pew Research Center, 2015 was the worst year since the 2008 recession for ad revenue. The number of daily newspapers has decreased by more than 100 since 2004. And as a journalist, this statistic was really a shocker for me. If you look inside newsrooms across the country, the number of journalists working in them is 20,000 fewer than it was 20 years ago. That's a 39% decline. David Motes, you've worked at the Herald since 1982. What kind of changes, staff-wise, reporter-wise, have you seen since you first began? at the paper?
The newsroom has held its own pretty well because I think the Mitchell family, they've always said our newsroom is larger for our size paper than it really than for most papers our size. So they have pared back, but the essential mission is that our city desk in Rutland still has five reporters. It used to have six. We used to have three reporters in Montpelier. We had two, but one recently resigned. I assume we're going to continue with two. The Springfield bureau is reduced from three to one. Although we now have a person in Bennington, so the ranks have thinned, and part of it is technology has allowed the paring back of layers of editors and so on. I wouldn't say that, you know, our newsroom reflects a 30% decline.
So it hasn't been as painful at the Rutland Herald.
It hasn't been quite as painful.
It has been
painful, but not as painful as that.
1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to weigh in on the future of newspapers, whether you think local, accurate journalism is important to you. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Let's go to the phones now. Let's take a call from Tyrone in Bakersfield. Hi, Tyrone. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks very much.
Go ahead.
I'm obviously very concerned about the fate of local news and community newspapers in the state. I teach journalism at Johnson State College, where our focus is on community journalism. And I think the essential tenet of that program is that newspapers are essential to the civic health of communities. And that means covering governance, local governance, effectively. Often that kind of reporting is something that larger newspapers just no longer do, beyond City Hall in the case of Burlington.
Tyrone, I think we've got it. Let me ask David Mindich to comment on that whole idea of the importance community-wise, democracy-wise, of getting local news out there.
Well, you know, journalism has a bunch of essential functions. One is holding leaders accountable. When you don't have as many reporters, politicians do bad things. Another is introducing various parts of the community to one another. Another is just promoting democracy through the accurate reporting of events. We have seen a decline nationwide. There's been in the last 10 years, there's been a 35% decline in state house reporters. Vermont
Wow.
is doing better. We have 13, which is actually about the median of, think about all the states, the 50 states. 13 is about the median of the 50 states. So we're doing well compared to states that are many of them, half of them are larger. We have more than half of the states in terms of state house reporters. Now, that's changing somewhat. Three or four reporters are from VT Digger, which is a new news organization, but still the Times, Argus, Rutland Herald, the Free Press, VPR, Television News, AP are all covering the State House. So Vermont's doing better than most states, but it's still a point of concern.
Well, and you talked about the reduction in reporters at state houses across the country. When you look at local towns and cities that have newspapers still in action, like Rutland, Montpelier, and Barrie, what role do they play locally, aside from the state news that they cover? What's their role for local coverage, and how important is that? And let me direct that to you, David Mindich. Sorry, I didn't mean to leave that floating out there.
Well, it's essential. And another factor that's coming into play now is that as newspapers are declining and as technology affords us information about which article is getting the most clicks, only the most mature editors can resist the siren call of clicks. You have newspapers around the country wanting to cover sexier topics. than city council meetings.
And by clicks, you mean people that are reading online that say, oh, I want to share this story or that story about the found puppies or the lost kittens.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that all of us like seeing a cat traveling on a Roomba. I mean, that's great stuff. But we also need, you know, that's the cotton candy part of our diet. We also need the vitamins and the healthy stuff, too, which includes city council meetings and finding, rooting out corruption where it exists, holding leaders accountable, and just covering these small towns, introducing the parts of these small towns that wouldn't necessarily meet if it weren't for a newspaper.
David Motz, let me ask you to weigh in on that issue as an editorial writer. What's your role in curating some of the most important stories of the day?
Well, as on the editorial page, I write the editorial, which is the position of the paper on an issue, which basically shows how one person thinks on an issue, and sort of as a way to start the discussion. But I also handle the letters to the editor and the op-ed pieces, and I like to keep a lively discussion going with points of view from all sides.
It is often very lively.
Yes, and as David Mindich says, it introduces parts of the community to each other. You know, we hear so often that people just go to their favorite websites to get the news they like. But if I can put something from the left on, I can put something from the right on, different points of view, it may drive some people crazy to read what their neighbor thinks, but it is breaking down those walls and showing that this is a community with diverse voices. And if we're going to be a community, we have to accept the fact we have diverse voices.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the future of local newspapers. Today on Vermont Edition, my guests are David Motz. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald, and David Mindich. He's a media historian and professor of journalism at St. Michael's College. You can join our discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones now and talk to Andrea, who's calling from Proctor. Hi, Andrea. What's on your mind today?
Well, hi, Nina. You know me. I feel like I have a very personal relationship with the newspaper. Every morning for the last 19 years, I go get it and then have my coffee and read it cover to cover. And I really miss not having it on that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday edition. I never once have opened up the newspaper online. That's not how I want to get my news. So I'm very hopeful that I guess I have 3 points. One is I'm very hopeful that with this new financial structure, we'll be able to bring back a full week's newspaper. Two, I just want to acknowledge both the pain and relief that I hear in Rob's voice. I can't imagine how difficult it's been for the family, and it is. I'm sure there's some grief, but I applaud their efforts to try to keep the Herald local. Third, I feel very strongly that local news is important, just as David just mentioned, showing all viewpoints. And I have to say that the Herald has always been very good to me when I've had local news to share, and it's played a very important role in getting the word out about any number of important topics happening locally. And then last, and this is my own personal opinion, but I really, my heart breaks to think of Alan Keyes no longer with the paper. He's been a loyal and steadfast editor there for years, and I would really hate to see his career with the Herald end over something, you know, as controversial as whether or not you report on yourself. I think his voice is really valuable, and I would like to see him brought back as soon as possible.
Andrea, thanks very much for that call and all your great points. And listeners, if you didn't hear earlier in the program, we asked Editor-in-Chief Rob Mitchell about the firing of Alan Keyes and whether or not that the longstanding editor, the news editor, Alan Keyes, might be coming back, and he wasn't ready to comment on that. David Mindich, many people say they don't subscribe to their local newspaper because they can get their news for free on the Internet or on Facebook, Instagram, Reddit, other online sources. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, one of the questions we have to ask as a community is what's the democracy that we need, and what do we need to foster that democracy in our news communities, in our news organizations, I should say. So So the answer is that we need reporters, paid reporters, who will devote their lives to digging, to getting the news right, to cultivating sources, and to really giving a truthful account of their communities. And you're just not going to get that randomly on Reddit. You're not going to get that randomly on just a Google search. I mean, the Google search will point you in the direction of paid newspaper and other reporters. So we need a news organization that pays its people. It sounds kind of basic, but in some way, one way or another, we need paid reporters who will ferret out news, devote potentially days, weeks, months to a story. That's the way that that democracy is fostered in this country and in the state.
Let me follow up. Are there new or innovative payment models that news organizations are experimenting with to get people to pay for news and realize, yeah, this is worth spending money on, aside from the subscription of old?
Right. You know, the old model of cutting down trees and schlepping newspapers all around town, I mean, it's kind of insane when you have the possibility of getting it on your iPhone or an iPad. But that's the model that was economically feasible for more than 100 years. And we had this happy coincidence where we had these people who were interested in delivering news, and that was the only way or the best way that advertisers could reach a public. And so cities and towns across America were able to get news for 150 years through this daily printed newspaper model. Now we see some increase in online advertisement, but it's not really matching the decrease in print advertising and sales. And one thing that I should just also say, your last caller talked about her personal relationship with a newspaper. You know, one of the beautiful things about a printed paper is the choreography on the front page of a paper telling you what the editor thinks or the editors think is the most important news. I'm sitting in the studio now with David Motz, and he has the Rutland Herald in front of him. And it's really a beautiful – I mean, I always think a front page of a newspaper is beautiful, but just in that there are many stories, maybe five or six stories on the front page. They all have different weights, different size headlines. And we know what the editor is telling us that we think should be important. And you miss that a lot online. Even some of the top papers like the New York Times don't do a really good job about ordering what they think is the most important stories. We get more of like what the latest story is or what the most popular story is.
I met a woman in Rutland who was very distraught that the 7 day a week physical paper had been reduced to four. And she said she sets aside segments of the Sunday paper to read on Monday and Tuesday, Wednesday. And she looked at me and said, I don't know why the Rutland Herald just doesn't do that. They've got plenty of news on Sunday to have three more papers. And I thought, oh, but she was just really upset not to have that physical paper in her hands. Briefly, David Mindich, let me ask you this question. Do you think the physical paper is going to be extinct in the not-too-distant future?
Well, no matter what the cost, if they print one copy, I'll be the one to buy it. But I don't know. I just don't know.
And David Motz, your thoughts on the future briefly of the newspaper?
Well, as for the printed paper, one advantage of the printed paper is that it's an advertisement for the paper. It's there in the community. People see it. They put their hands on it. And so there is that role. But it is costly to the newsprint is costly, the delivery is costly. They're looking for the right balance, cost balance of you know, they reduced to 4 days a week. You know, some towns have 1 day a week. You know,
right.
I don't know. 7 days a week is great. It's best, but who knows what's going to happen?
Maybe it's a luxury we simply can't afford anymore. David Motz is the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial page editor of the Rutland Herald. He is also a VPR commentator. David, I really, really appreciate you making time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Nina.
And David Mindich is a media historian and a professor of journalism at St. Michael's College. Professor Mindich, thanks very much to you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Nina.
Coming up, the Battle of Bennington, which wasn't actually really fought in Bennington. That's a little misleading, but this is one battle that was hugely important for the outcome of the Revolutionary War. We'll hear why next. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. The course of history is often shaped by the outcome of battles, even small ones. That's the case with the Battle of Bennington, which was fought back in August 1777, more than 2 years after the start of the Revolutionary War. Phil Holland says it marked the moment in the European settlement of North America when power tipped from the old world to the new. Holland is an English teacher at Community College of Vermont and the author of the new book, A Guide to the Battle of Bennington and the Bennington Monument. He joins me now to talk about the battle and why it was so important in helping the colonists defeat the British. Phil Holland, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Nina, nice to talk to you.
Well, first of all, before we get into the details of the Battle of Bennington, I found it interesting that it wasn't, in fact, fought in Bennington. So what gives on that?
The supply depot that the British Army was after was located in Bennington, and a detachment was sent by General Burgoyne towards Bennington to capture cattle and wagons. What Burgoyne didn't realize was that there were 1,500 New Hampshire militiamen recently raised from New Hampshire in response to a call from Vermont that were right there in Bennington and that went out to meet the advancing detachment, and they encountered each other in the little hamlet of Wollumsack, just over the Vermont-New York border.
So this battle occurred in 1777, well after the Green Mountain Boys had taken Fort Ticonderoga from the British in 1775. Explain briefly what was going on in the months leading up to the Battle of Bennington.
The British had failed to put down the rebellion in 75 and 76, although they almost accomplished it in New York in 1776. And so they decided to get serious. And General Burgoyne conceived a plan whereby he would invade from Canada down the Champlain corridor towards the Hudson with about 9,000 men. He would be met there by another British force advancing from the west down the Mohawk Valley, and a third force coming up from New York, which never came. And so they would lop the New England colonies off from the rest of the colonies and thereby isolate them. They were the most rebellious colonies, and that was to put an end to things.
But, you know, it's interesting. Your article explains how Burgoyne, the British general, had the superior manpower. You mentioned how many thousands were coming down from Canada and various other points. But talk about some of the logistical challenges they faced. I was surprised to hear about that there was a shortage of draft animals to pull the equipment and supplies. There was a shortage of horses. And the fact that a lot of their food was brought in from Canada or from England, which is probably why they were headed for Bennington.
That's right. And ultimately, it was the logistics that were Burgoyne's undoing. Eventually, he ran out of food, for that matter, in September, October, when he was defeated at Saratoga. But to provision an army of close to 9,000 men and to float supplies upriver from the St. Lawrence, from Montreal, all the way to Ticonderoga and Fort George and eventually Albany, that was a tall order when you don't have adequate, especially animals, to drag your guns and your supplies. Merely to feed your horses takes a lot of hay.
Right.
And that's what he wanted.
So, and as far as I understand from your article, he found out that this supply storehouse was in Bennington, and didn't they change routes and said, let's go there instead?
Yeah, they were headed straight to Albany, but they thought they'd just make a little foray, a raid into Bennington, and pick up a few supplies.
Get some groceries.
Yeah, so to speak. They sent a force of 650 men, most of them German. There were only 50 British soldiers in that British detachment. The rest were mercenaries from the German state of Brunswick, but they were professionals, and they thought they had easy pickings there in Bennington. It didn't turn out to be the case.
They were met with a lot more opposition than they expected. You write that General George Washington predicted with amazing accuracy how this battle and the situation with Burgoyne and the German mercenaries would unfold. How did he know?
Well, that's almost a month before, when things were not looking good. Burgoyne took back Ticonderoga without a fight. He simply threatened the American defenses, and the Americans put their tails between their legs and escaped by night. That was humiliating for the bulwark of northern defenses just to collapse like that. And about 10 days later, Washington very confidently predicted that Burgoyne, in his overconfidence, would make a mistake. In fact, would divide his force, would send a detachment of, and he almost called the numbers right, 400, 500, 600 men. And if the Americans could beat that detachment, defeat them, it would spirit up the American cause, and people would enlist. Psychologically, there would be relief. Now, at this point, there were no signs on the horizon that this might take place. The New Hampshiremen had not yet even been recruited. But Washington, or perhaps his handy 22-year-old aide-de-camp, Hamilton, who did a lot of his correspondence, and for that matter, thinking for him, conceived what would happen, and sure enough, that's exactly the way it happened. Astonishing.
General Stark, who was leading some of the New Hampshire soldiers, I understand had scouts pretending to be British loyalists, passing through these British and German troops to assess their strengths and do some spying. How dangerous was that, and how often did that kind of spying go on?
It must have been very difficult for the British-German contingent. I mean, the German commander didn't even speak English, to distinguish between loyalists and colonists, who were often friends and neighbors, or at least enemies and neighbors, relations in some cases. And they were loyalists joining the British all the time. So if you arrived in camp, declared yourself a loyalist, you'd
it's
swear
pretty
an
hard
oath.
It's pretty hard to tell the difference, it sounds like.
Yeah, they'd be dressed, they'd have the same appearance and language, and they wouldn't all know each other, so these New Hampshiremen could present themselves as new recruits.
And how important was the information those spies brought back to the colonial forces?
It must have been very important, because it rained heavily the day after the first sighting of one force by the other. And so the Americans had a chance to scout the positions and knew just where each defense was, how many people were in it, and developed a plan to envelop the forces based on the information they had. So their intelligence was much better than the British intelligence of the U.S. force.
Well, the battle, when it finally came on August 17th, sounds fierce. How long did it last, and what happened?
It was not one, but two battles, or even more if you count the particular fights in various places. But certainly there were two engagements. Each side had sent for reinforcements when they first encountered each other on the 14th. And especially on the German side, the British side, those reinforcements were anxiously awaited. There was another force of equal size on the way, but it got delayed in the mud, and they lost their way, and their horses hadn't been fed. And the Americans, too, had asked the Green Mountain Boys, or Continental Rangers as they were, who were up in Manchester, to come down and help out. Neither force had arrived, but Stark sent out the signal to attack at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the battle raged for 2 hours. The Americans won, but of course the battle wasn't over, because then the German reinforcements arrived, just a little too late to offer the kind of resistance that they could have had they been on time. And they began to turn the tide and win the day. The colonial forces, the American forces, were dispersed and mopping up and drinking rum. So the Germans advanced, and at that moment, just when the cause appeared to be lost, Seth Warner's Green Mountain contingent arrived. They were experienced soldiers who had a score to settle because they'd been defeated at Hubbardton. And they, in turn, turned the tide again and defeated that second force.
And it sounds like
set in.
And that battle ripple effect really helped kind of turn the tide for the finish of the war later on.
In two ways. One, Burgoyne lost men and materiel, but and never got his provisions, which delayed his advance to Saratoga and Albany. But it also psychologically dealt a blow to Burgoyne and inspired the Americans to enlist, so that when Burgoyne finally made it to north of Albany, there were many to oppose him there.
Well, I'll have to leave it there. Phil Holland, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nina.
Phil Holland is an English teacher at Community College of Vermont and the author of the new book, A Guide to the Battle of Bennington and the Bennington Monument. Well, that's it for today. We've spent a lot of time this summer looking at the candidates who challenged each other in the primary election races, but all the while there have been candidates who already knew they'd be on the November ballot. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at the matchups. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gil Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. From the PEG TV studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Kack. Thanks for listening.